Open your Bibles to Esther. Several passages, as you see. First, in Esther, chapter 3, verse 1. As you recall, on Mother's Day, I focused my sermon. We looked at Esther also. I focused it well on Esther. We titled it, An Unlikely Hero. Love that. Today, on this Father's Day, I'm focusing on Mordecai, and we're calling it the Great Reversal, which I love too. But you know, we're not focusing on Esther or Mordecai, really, but on Esther and Mordecai's God. So let's hear God's word. Esther 3. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Well, let's see the end of that effort. Chapter 9, verse 1. Now, in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought them harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Parshandatha and Dalphon and Aspatha and Poratha and Adalia and Aridatha and Parmashta and Arisai and Aridai and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they laid no hand on the plunder. And I really don't know if I got that pronunciation correct. Well, let's see the last chapter. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. And all the acts of his power and might and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. And the grass withers, flowers fade, and the word of our God, it endures forever. And this story, though, of ancient peoples and ancient customs, it's written with you in mind also. Thanks be to God. Well, because of the steadfast love of God in Christ, we know that Psalm 30 is indisputably true when it says, "You have turned for me my mourning into dancing. You have loosed my sackcloth, and you have clothed me with joy." The book of Esther illustrates this truth. Reversal is a pivotal theme of Esther. It makes the book of Esther not a tragedy, if you want to classify it literarily. It's not a tragedy, but in the deepest sense, it's a comedy. It's not a story of sadness, it's a story of celebration. We're supposed to laugh all the way through Esther. Today, in the Feast of Purim, Jews laugh throughout the story. We laugh at it. Because the book of Esther, it starts off very threatening, but it ends with the Feast of Purim, or Purim. And we've got to see the humor of that. Haman casts lots, which are called the poor. He casts lots to determine what day he wants to exterminate the Jews. And so when God turns his plans imperceptibly upside down, the Jews name their holiday Purim. It's funny. By chance, he's trying to figure out the day, but there's a God who sets days and seasons and years. All right, there's a whole lot to say. We're going to abbreviate as much as possible. The story takes place in Susa. It's the capital city of the Medo-Persian Empire. It's the greatest kingdom that exists at this time. It goes from India all the way to Ethiopia. It's so powerful and so big. And I love this story because you have a big, powerful kingdom and these little people that God cherishes and that are more important than the big, powerful kingdom. It's a lesson for us. So it takes place 483 BC to 478, 477 BC. Remember that, you know, when Cyrus, the Medo-Persian king, when he defeated Babylon and he issued his edict in 539 that the Jews could go back to Jerusalem. Some of them did, but really a minority, kind of the more zealous ones that wanted to nation build. They go back to Jerusalem, but most of them stay in exile in the Medo-Persian Empire. They had made a life for themselves, many of them doing very well, very comfortable, second, third generation Babylonian Medo-Persian now. And so the story opens with King Ahasuerus. He's throwing this ridiculous, laughable 180-day party. And his display of opulence is just, I mean, it's laughable. He's all about appearing to be the greatest person alive, the greatest king alive. The only problem is there's another king that never appears, but whose actions behind the scenes are far more powerful than Ahasuerus's. So on the last night, the grand finale of his party, his officials are good and drunk, and he calls for his beautiful wife, Queen Vashti. He wants her to appear before, you know, this group of men, to show off his greatness by displaying his trophy wife. And to her credit, Ahasuerus says, "No, I am not doing that." The only problem is you don't oppose the will of Ahasuerus and you don't oppose the empire. What happens to you? You get stripped of your role and banished. Well, the king wants another queen. So he orders a forced beauty pageant throughout his empire. He wants to gather all the attractive young ladies and add them to his harem, and from that group select a new queen. So we meet Mordecai, and we meet his young cousin Esther, who's also his adoptive daughter. And she happens to be gorgeous. And she happens to live in the capital city of Susa. Therefore, she is quickly scooped up into the harem. There's really no question. And so Mordecai and Esther are both Jewish. Nevertheless, they both seem at this stage to be nominal in their faith. Or maybe it's a genuine faith, but it's buried deep. They're kind of Romans 12:2. They become squeezed into the mold of the world. And it happens. They're living a compromised life. Mordecai even advises Esther, when she's taken into the harem, don't tell them who your people and your kindred are. Hide it. Hide who you are. The contrast between them and Daniel is striking. So she does just that. She hides who she is. Nobody knows it. She lives in close proximity to all these people, and no one knows she's Jewish. Not only that, but she sets herself to being the best trophy wife candidate there. She pleases everybody. She's been given a ladder to success, and she takes it. So it just so happens that she wins the king's favor, and she becomes his wife, and this little exiled, orphaned Jewish girl becomes Queen Esther. Mordecai is a lesser official to the king. That's what the phrase "sit at the king's gate" means. So one day it happens. It happens. While he's at his post, he overhears this plot to assassinate the king, and he passes the word to Esther. Esther gets the word to the king. The king investigates and finds that it's true, and he executes those two would-be assassins on a gallows. The event is recorded in the chronicles of the king, but it just so happens that it's forgotten. Unusually so, but it's forgotten. Then, when you would think the next scene in the story is that something good happens to Mordecai, instead, this other guy appears on the scene. His name is Haman the Agagite, and he's promoted to second in charge of the empire, a kind of prime minister. And the king commands that everyone bow down and pay him homage. And everybody does it. Except Mordecai won't do it. Like, he refuses to do it. Haman doesn't really notice him until a bit later when people tell him about it, but he won't do it. He stands. And it just so happens, when the other servants ask him why, that Mordecai now reveals that he's Jewish, and it's due to the fact that he's Jewish that he will not bow. And so we wonder, how do the two things relate, not bowing and being Jewish? And it's not some strong stand on the first commandment. It's not because he's convinced that this is an issue of you shall have no other gods before me. That's not the issue. I mean, he's been bowing to Ahasuerus. It's not like Daniel and his friends when Nebuchadnezzar makes this gold statue and says, worship it. That's not what's going on here. This is a Romans 13 matter. This is showing honor to those in authority. So that's really not the issue. So why does Mordecai refuse to bow? Well, it is a stand he's making, but it's a little less clear. And the clue is given in the fact that Haman is earlier identified as, well, Haman is identified as Haman the Agagite. That's important. And Mordecai earlier was identified as a descendant of Kish, a Benjamite. Does that ring any bells? So Haman comes from the Amalekites, and Mordecai comes from the family of Saul. Okay, now recall 1,000 years ago. This is bad blood for years. 1,000 years ago, Moses is rescuing Israel. He's marching them from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai, and a tribe comes out, the Amalekites, and wage war on them. And that's the story where Moses on the mountain, he raises his hands and Israel wins. He lowers his hands and Israel loses. They win. And God at that moment pronounces a curse upon the Amalekites. He says, I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. God declares judgment, holy war on Amalek for going after his beloved people. So years later, when Saul is king, God charges him to carry out this holy war and destroy the descendants of Amalek, represented by King Agag. If you remember that story, 1 Samuel 15, to destroy all of them and everything they have, and Saul and Israel were to be God's instrument of judgment that he might carry out his holy war. But recall the story that Saul does defeat them, but he spares King Agag and the best of the livestock. He doesn't obey God and devote them all to destruction as God desired in his judgment upon them. So the Lord rebukes Saul and rejects him as king. That was the turning point. All right, so now we're 500 years later with Mordecai being told to bow before Haman the Agagite. So what's going on? Well, with Mordecai and Haman the Agagite. So we got to imagine Mordecai looking at Haman, knowing where he comes from, and saying, well, this is a descendant of a cursed enemy of the Jews, a people my great ancestor failed to enact judgment on. And I just can't, like principally, I can't bow down to him. And maybe if I bow down to them, that would be the equivalent of Saul not completely destroying the descendants of Amalek. I can't do it. And so it is a stand, and it seems good that Mordecai manifests his convictions. Previously, he hadn't really manifested convictions. It's good that he makes a stand. It's certainly good that he reveals that he's Jewish, but at the same time, we just wonder whether he should have renewed his obedience in a clearer way. Like, there are other things he could have done. But, you know, we look in our lives, that sometimes secondary areas of obedience wake us up to more profound areas of disobedience. Something in our culture might pique our attention and go, wow. But then we go, wait, but like I'm living my life like a practical atheist. Like, that's the real issue. Well, Mordecai's disrespect is just intolerable to Haman. He's full of fury, and his Amalek lineage comes out in full color when he said, well, it's not just enough for me to go after Mordecai. I'm going to erase them all, like every last one of them. He looks like the seed of the serpent here. So with his seething anger, he begins to plot and scheme. It's the first month of the year, and he starts casting lots, the pur, to figure out the date to exterminate the Jews. And it so happens that the pur, or the poor, falls on the 12th month of Adar. And, you know, that's a long way away, which thankfully, in God's sovereignty, it gives time for things to happen. We got to think of Proverbs 16:33. The lot is cast in the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. You might think it's chance, but it's not. Haman then goes to the king and accuses a certain people. He doesn't identify them as the Jews. He just calls them a certain people. All these people, all of them, are being so rebellious that the king needs to sign and seal a decree, the law of the Medes and Persians that can't be broken, recall in Daniel, to destroy, kill, annihilate, and plunder all the Jews in the whole empire on the 13th day of Adar. And we see the gross self-absorption of the king in that he doesn't even investigate it. Like, he makes no inquiry. He just says, okay, that sounds like a good idea. I trust you. Let's exterminate this whole people in the empire. they're so unimportant to him, they don't even make any investigation. Like the church is so unimportant to the kingdoms of the world. But you see, there's another king who's behind the scenes for whom the church is very important. Well, Mordecai soon learns about the decree and immediately tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth and ashes, goes out in the streets and just weeps and cries bitterly. He tells Esther what's going on, that she needs to reveal her Jewishness too and plead for the king on behalf of her people. But Esther responds kind of dubiously. She goes, well, you know that if I enter the king's presence without being summoned, and I hadn't been summoned for 30 days, it's not looking good, I'll be executed unless he extends to me the golden scepter. To which Mordecai responds in his famous words, he's recovered some deep convictions. Relief and deliverance for the Jews is going to arise. But if you don't do your part, you will perish, and you will forgo the opportunity to save us. And who knows whether you have not come to this kingdom for such a time as this. So Esther comes to her senses, has a renewal of faith, asks Mordecai and the Jews in Susa to fast 3 days and three nights. She and her women, now she's revealed who she is, are going to fast this time. And she determines that she's going to risk it all, go to the king, and she says her famous words, if I perish, I perish. And so we see in this interchange that the God is never named. It's like the ground when it's rained a lot and you step on the ground and water comes up. You see that God is pressing through all their actions and all their words. You don't talk like that unless God is becoming real to you. Why would Mordecai say so confidently his only plan of attack is you go before the king, and then to say, really let her off the hook. Relief and deliverance will arise. It looks like he's renewed his faith in God's covenant promises. So Esther enters the king's presence, and it just so happens that he does extend to her the golden scepter. He says, what do you want? Up to half my kingdom. And she says, I want you and Haman to come over for a feast that I've prepared for you. And so the king calls for Haman, and they go, and it just so happens that Esther isn't just beautiful, she's really smart and crafty, astute. God has designed her for this role. The king asks her what she wants, and again, he says, up to half the kingdom. And she replies, I want you and Haman to come to a feast tomorrow night. And it just so happens then that as Haman returns home, he encounters none other than Mordecai, who again won't bow, like he's just tenacious. And so Haman again gets furious. He goes home, tells his wife and friends, and they go, we know what you need to do. Build a gallows 75 feet high, like the big one. And in the morning, tell the king you want to hang Mordecai on those gallows and then go off and enjoy your feast. I mean, that's what you do. I mean, that's the logical step if somebody doesn't bow. So it just keeps getting worse. But now we hit the turning point in the story. And it's interesting, the turning point happens without Mordecai and without Esther. What happens that turns the story? Well, what happens is, it just so happens that the king can't sleep. And he doesn't have some big dream like Nebuchadnezzar. And he isn't suffering from anxiety over his plan to carry out an ethnic cleansing campaign. He just can't fall asleep. And not only that, but it just so happens that he decides to fall asleep by reading the riveting tale of the Chronicles of his kingdom. And it just so happens that he reads about how Mordecai saved him from being assassinated. And it just so happens that when he reads that, he notices that no reward was ever given to Mordecai for such an act. And so in the morning, the king asks his servant which advisor is in the court. And it just so happens that Haman has just arrived to ask the king to execute Mordecai on the gallows he just built. But before Haman can make his request, the king asks him, Haman, what should be done to the man who the king delights to honor? And the king doesn't identify who he's talking about, but Haman, being as vain as he is, he's sure it must be him. So he replies, well, you got to dress that man in one of your royal robes, put one of your royal crowns on him, set him on a horse you've ridden, and have a noble official lead him throughout the city proclaiming, this is what's done for the man the king delights to honor. And so everybody's laughing who's listening to the story. But then to Haman's horror, the king says, great, do this for Mordecai the Jew. And so Haman's dream turns into his worst nightmare. And when he returns home after doing this, his wise men and his wife say these ominous words, if Mordecai before whom you have begun to fall is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. It looks like the pagans know covenant promises. They know Genesis 12:3, I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. Well, at that moment, the king's servants come to Haman's house, and they get him for the feast, and gathered again with Esther at her house for the feast, the king again looks at her and says, what do you want, Esther? Up to half my kingdom, I'll give it to you. And we see once again how astute Esther is, because now she's gotten the king to commit to giving her up to half the kingdom three times. On his honor, he can't go back. Therefore, at this moment, she springs her attack, her trap. She says, well, if I have found favor in your eyes, then save my people, save me, for we have been condemned to be annihilated. And the king lashes out, who would dare to do this? And she says, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. For his edict is against my people, and my people are the Jews. And notice here, she doesn't appeal to the king's sense of justice. That just doesn't go anywhere with Ahasuerus. She's appealing to his love for her. She's banking on him seeing an attack on his favorite wife, his queen, as an attack on himself. That's the kind of thing that speaks to Ahasuerus, and that's her line of argument. And it just so happens that, sure enough, he does delight in her. He does view it that way, and he does get furious. And that's not to mention that he's just honored Mordecai the Jew. It just so happens. So enraged, the king turns on Haman, and he hangs Haman, the enemy of the Jews, on the 75-foot gallows that Haman had built. He gives Haman's property to Esther, and he puts Mordecai in Haman's spot as second in the kingdom, the new prime minister. But still, there's this irrevocable verdict, outstanding, that's coming due on the 13th day of Adar. So Esther, again, reaches down deep and risks her life again and goes into the king's inner court. And it just so happens that the king again extends to her the golden scepter. And so Esther falls on her knees and pleads on behalf of her people. And the king permits Esther and Mordecai, now in places of authority, to write another decree in the name of the king that can't be broken, the law of the Medes and the Persians, that on the 13th day of Adar, the Jews can gather, defend their lives and property, and kill any who come against them, and as they write it, even women and children, and plunder their goods. And just like Haman's decree, this one is signed and sealed and sent all throughout the empire. But while that's going on, Mordecai is serving as prime minister now. He's dressed in royal clothes of blue and purple and white linen. Like the king, he enjoys the favor and esteem of everybody in Susa. And the Jews throughout the empire are filled with gladness and joy. And amazingly, many Gentiles become Jews. For the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. Instead of extermination, they're multiplying. There's a little bit of a revival going on. And so on the 13th of Adar, the day the enemies of the Jews plotted to gain the mastery over them, it just so happens that a reverse occurs. and the Jews gain mastery over those who hate them. And the fear of the Jews and of Mordecai had so fallen on the people and over all their leaders that they actually supported them and didn't attack them against their enemies. And both in Susa and the whole empire, the Jews enjoy a resounding victory. Their status rises. And two important details to see what's going on. In Susa, they hang Haman's 10 sons on the gallows. Why? And then throughout the empire, three times it says the Jews don't take the plunder of their enemies. Why? It was legal to do so. But these two details mean this is holy war. Enemies in holy war were hung on a tree to emphasize God's curse upon them. In holy war, you didn't take the plunder, you devoted it to destruction. This was holy war, judgment. And with their thoroughgoing victory, Esther and Mordecai declare a feast to commemorate and celebrate their incredible victory. The poor of Haman casts becomes the Feast of Purim. 2 days of feasting, joy, generosity, and gift giving. And again, Psalm 30, you have turned my mourning into dancing. You have loosed my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness. It's not a tragedy. It's a comedy in the best sense of the term. And so a few applications for us, real quick, especially on Father's Day. Fathers, especially for you today. What are some things we learned? Just three quick things. First, Esther is about God's sovereign working. And fathers, you need to know that. Even when we don't notice it, and even when we don't feel his presence, even when he doesn't appear, he's acting behind the scenes. Esther's the only book of the Bible that never mentions the name of God. It never does. Never specifically refers to God. So why does Mordecai, whoever wrote the book, why does he never mention God? We can think of a few things, but I think mainly, I agree with those who say, he's showing that God is always working behind the scenes, oftentimes in hidden ways. That it's not Ahasuerus, but it's the true king that's working. He doesn't part the Red Sea. He doesn't send manna down. But he's working through little events that just so happen. I think it's a subtle evangelism for the kingdom of Persia. Watch out for your big bad king. There's another king who's acting behind the scenes. In fact, we can say that Esther's a story version or the narrative version of Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purposes. You want to put flesh and bones on that? One way, go to Esther. He's going to fulfill his covenant purposes. He made promises, and he's going to do it. He's going to fulfill his purposes for his church in the world. He's going to fulfill his purposes for your family. Fathers, take this to heart. Second, Esther is about God using very imperfect people. We'd never say, dare to be an Esther or dare to be a Mordecai. In the same way, we'd say, dare to be a Daniel. But God got their attention. He renewed their faith. He used them. He even used their prior compromise with the world to put them where they needed to be in order that he could get their attention and use them for the extension of his kingdom of grace. Like, you're never on plan B. You didn't forsake your usefulness. He uses even our failings for his glory and our good. Fathers, take that to heart. Grace is more amazing than we even fathom. Third. We are a people who live in the gospel of God's great reversal. And it creates laughter and festivity and celebration in this story, and it does so in our lives, even in hard places. Haman wants to hang Mordecai on the gallows, but Haman is hanged instead. He wants to disgrace Mordecai, but Mordecai is honored and praised instead by him. He wants to exterminate the Jews and erase them from memory, but they're protected. They grow in numbers and they enjoy more respect and renown than ever. It's an incredible reversal. But though amazing as that reversal is, it's not the great reversal, nor the great deliverance. And one of the ways you see that is at the end of the chapter, King Ahasuerus levies a bunch of taxes on the empire. And you kind of go, why is that there? Just set to say, well, he's still the guy in charge, and he's not the true king, and he's still a threat to God's people. Things really hadn't changed. So who do we need, or what do we need? And Esther points to him. We need the king behind the scenes, and he becomes the main pivotal actor on the stage of history. That's what we need. God the Son becomes flesh so that God the Father can unleash holy war against him. God the Father destroys, kills, annihilates God the Son. He judges him for our sin on the cross. He curses him by hanging him on the gallows. The gospel is the true reversal, the one we need, sinners like us need. So Jesus, though infinitely rich, becomes infinitely poor to make us infinitely rich. Jesus, though exalted to the highest place, goes down to the lowest place in order to raise us up to the heights. Jesus, who undergoes the scheming of the serpent, does so in order to then crush the serpent. It's all a reversal. So we see when Ahasuerus extends the golden scepter to Esther, we see the Father extending the golden scepter to us. We see when Ahasuerus says, "What shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" We see the Father incredibly delighting to honor us in Christ. So Jesus gives us his record that we might be counted righteous. He takes our guilt that we might be forgiven. He's disowned at the cross in order that we might be adopted sons and daughters of God. This is the great reversal. And one day he'll even return to bring us into the full relief, deliverance, gladness, and celebration of the true feast, which is the marriage supper of the Lamb, where there'll be no more mourning, crying, pain, or death. And so now we live in light of the great reversal. We're called to place our faith and just give our lives to him. And there is no king like him. And so that's the summons to us today. Would you place your faith in him? And then in relationship with such a king, we enter his upside down kingdom. We know the end, we know the way, and our lives become a joyful self-offering and self-giving for the eternal good of others. And as we do so, we sit back, we watch as things just seem to happen. And so fathers, take all that to heart. Such a gracious king is using you where he's placed you. And as we echo that self-giving, he unleashes his grace in our midst. May God add his blessing. Amen. Let's stand.